Commissioner Thorburn. Okay, that wraps up agenda item one. Before I go into open public input, I have to step away for another Zoom call at about 8:55. At that point, I will ask Vice Chair Baker to take over the meeting. I shouldn't be gone more than about 10 minutes for those of you that care. Okay, we're moving into agenda item two, open public comment. Nikki, would you do the preamble, please?
We will now take public comment from attendees. As a reminder, everyone receives 3 minutes for comment. If you pre-registered, we'd still ask that you raise your hand so we can see you in the queue. Everyone is currently muted. If you're on the computer, the raise hand button appears under your name. If you're on the phone, please press *9 and wait to hear you have been unmuted. That's your indication. It is your time to speak. All right, we are going to start with Mr. Sudar. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thank you. I just want to say quickly, this is Robert Sudar from Longview. I'm a commercial advisor on the Columbia, a salmon marketer and former commercial fisherman. And I'd like to see those new rules printed out, please, hopefully before the next meeting. I did not see the typical please sign in if you want to testify portion of the sign up that I'd seen in the past. So I was wondering if I was going to get a chance to talk at all today. And I don't know why that came up, but I just think there could be a glitch in the system, and I'd like some time to work through these changes. It's hard for those of us who run businesses and have other responsibilities to fit our lives into the pattern of testimony and the like with that the commission offers. So I have some reservations about those new guidelines. I'd like to see them printed and get a chance for some public comment before you interact or before you activate them. But my testimony today is about Summer Chinook. I sent a letter out this past week that you all should have gotten. I think I sent it on Monday regarding Summer Chinook fishery in the Columbia this year. Summer Chinook are not ESA listed. The ESA listed stocks in the river at that time are sockeye and steelhead. We used to have a gillnet fishery that shared the run 50-50 with the recreational fishery on the allocation below Priest Rapids Dam. The initial policy in 2013 began reducing that, and since 16, we haven't had any fishery for that. The revisions last week, or last September rather, did provide us with the opportunity to have a fishery again on a sliding scale, depending on the return. It would allow us a fishery this year. Now we're facing some issues with Oregon on getting that fishery back. It doesn't fit their current policy, though their commissioners that were on the committee when we went through the policy review in Washington 3 years ago and various joint meetings were in favor of giving us a chance to have that fishery again. I pointed out that our fishery is compliant with USV Oregon, that the tribal fishery above Bonneville and the ocean fishery are not selective. The stock is not ESA listed, so there's no reason for us to have to fit a selective fishery into that. There's no alternative gear that fits. The Colville Agreement provides flexibility for our fishery if there is no alternative gear available, and our gillnets are effective at avoiding sockeye and steelhead, which I said were the critical stocks in the river at that time. I'm hoping that when the directors get together to discuss these issues, that we don't just agree with Oregon and have no fishery. There is room for compromise in terms of when we start fishing and allowing the recreational fishery to have a head start on us. There are other things that can be done to still allow us to have that fishery. It's important to our fishermen. It's important to our communities. It's important to the markets that would be receiving those fish and the public that will get a chance to eat them. And it's really frustrating to those of us in the industry to see selectivity used as a weapon against us in this fishery when it doesn't fit this fishery. We used to attend North of Falcon meetings where neither fishery fished selectively.
And then, time, Robert.
Okay, I'll wrap it up. They used to fish They asked for a longer season, so they fished selectively to create a longer season. As soon as they got it, then they used it as a weapon against us. And so I'm encouraging you to look at the letter I wrote, recognize that there's nothing that should be precluding that fishery, and that the director be assigned a way to, if he has to compromise with Oregon, to still create a fishery for us this year, rather than having us miss another year, another good return of that healthy stock, excellent stock. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert, for your comments. Commissioner McKaysey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Mr. Sudar, for sending that letter in writing. That does help for us to take a look at it. When I looked at that letter, you had a table in there that might get a little bit to your comments on selectivity and the health of the wild stock. And it showed that the runs at Priest Rapids Dam have been between 40 and 80,000 in recent years. We've got a pretty strong forecast this year as well. And the footnote says that the goal is 20,000 at Priest Rapids Dam for composite wild and hatchery, and something about a wild escapement goal. But I guess if the run's been about 50% marked or something like that, it would look like we have been exceeding the wild escapement goal at Priest Rapids Dam maybe every year since 2008. So am I interpreting that table right? And it gets to your question about the health of the wild run, because we do selectively fish for hatchery fish when we
Don,
have problems with wild fish. But
Don,
we don't in the fall, for example, for upriver brights.
Pardon my interruption, Don, but per our meeting with the executive committee, this was not a clarifying question that you're asking. And we were going to try and save these to the end of the public comment period. You were in agreement with that?
Yes, I was, and it's a clarification of his testimony relative to selectivity. He had a table about wild and hatchery mix, and I'm asking him whether that table is accurate, and what did he mean by 20,000 in that table with regard to a wild goal, or is that a wild and a hatchery goal?
Well, the table applied to spawning escapements in the tributaries. The goal over Priest Rapids Dam in USV Oregon is 20,000. It's wild and hatchery fish. It's been met every year since that fishery was reopened, and usually far exceeded. The table is from USV Oregon, and it addresses the combined hatchery and wild escapement in the tributaries. The Washington department has decided that's the wild escapement, whereas the USV Oregon identifies it as combined wild and hatchery escapement. And that was my complaint, is that we just changed that in within the department to a wild goal rather than the USV Oregon goal of wild and hatchery. And the other part that's a problem in this is that there's a large portion of the run that spawns in the main stem that's wild. We don't know exactly how much that is, but we know it's significant. And the mark rate is in the 40 to 60 range. And that also doesn't lend itself to as successful a mark selective fishery when you have that many wild fish mixed in.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Robert. Nikki, next, please.
Next, we have David Lynn. And for quick clarification, I was having survey issues and I did submit a ticket to Zoom, but it clearly didn't get resolved. So my apologies to the public who didn't have that clarity for signing up. Go ahead, David.
Good morning, commissioners. I'm David Lynn, representing myself. I've been attending the public meetings held by the Office of the Chehalis Basin, where they're dealing with flooding and habitat issues in the Chehalis River Basin. It's my understanding that the department has been involved in the processes, along with other organizations, to a greater or lesser extent. There are two distinct parts to the process: the aquatic species habitat restoration and the flood damage reduction. The department's website discusses the habitat restoration part of the program, which seems to have some significant promise for improving the habitat and survivability of fish in the Chehalis River. It does not mention the flood damage proposal. The flood damage reduction part of the program still contains a proposal to build a water retention dam on the Chehalis River to hold back water during heavy precipitation events. Based upon the results of the draft environmental impact statement by the Department of Ecology It is astonishing that this dam is still being discussed as a possible solution. The summary table included in the draft EIS describes the following impact on fish, aquatic species, and aquatic habitat function: temporarily dewatering the river, reduced fish passage survival, permanent elimination of a portion of aquatic habitat, degraded riparian function, reduced nutrient availability, removal of 600 acres of trees, recurring flooding of up to 847 acres of vegetation, reduction in channel forming flows, water temperature increases and dissolved oxygen decreases, and increased turbidity downstream from reservoir releases. All of these things will have a negative impact on the survival of our fish and will destroy a significant area of wildlife habitat and will create a significant amount of pollution during construction. As I mentioned, the department's website discusses the habitat restoration, but it's not clear to me how much input the department has had on the flood reduction ideas. Given the devastating effect that this dam would have on the fish populations and wildlife habitat, I think that the department should take a public position in strong opposition to the dam. Both the Quinault Indian Nation and the Confederated Tribes of the Chehalis Reservation have stated their opposition to the dam because of the great damage that it would cause. The two proposals are separate, and the department can support the habitat restoration while opposing the dam construction. I'm asking that you do so. With the time that I have left, I'd like to express my sadness at the massive slaughter of more than 200 wolves in Wisconsin this past week. Using hounds, traps, snares, and guns, it took only 2.5 days for this bloody massacre. With wolves having been delisted by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in January, this was a rush to kill as many wolves as possible. Given what we have seen in Idaho, Wyoming, and Montana, this was completely predictable. Yet the department supported this unwarranted delisting, knowing full well that it was sentencing thousands of wolves to their deaths. It is a dark stain that will long live with the department. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Lynn. Next, Nikki.
Next, we have Mike Henderson, followed by Marie Newmiller. Go ahead, Mike. Make sure to unmute yourself. There's always a slack. Okay, well, I'm going to move on to Marie and come back to Mike.
That better?
Yes. Yes, we can hear you now. Go ahead, Mike.
Okay, I'm sorry. I was doing the keyboard thing. My name is Mike Henderson, and I'm a recreational fisherman. I want to thank you for the opportunity to comment. I was born in Washington in 1956. As a boy, I trout fished with my grandpa, my uncles, and my dad. In 1969, when I was 13, my dad bought a 16-foot saltwater-capable boat. We usually fished at Mukilteo and ran over to Possession Bar. We mostly mooched and taught ourselves how to salmon fish. We'd buy live herring from a truck on Highway 99 at like 4:30 in the morning and then go to the launch ramp. Having a salmon take your bait and peel off a bunch of line was a huge thrill, and I was as hooked as the fish were. I caught a 27-pound Chinook on an old throwaway surf casting rod and saltwater spinning reel when I was 13. I had never seen a fish that big, and I thought it could be a record, so I wanted to come in and get it weighed. In 1975, I went off to college and literally did not fish for salmon again until retiring 3 years ago, a gap of 43 years. Well, in all honesty, there were a couple of Westport charters in those 43 years, but I'm trying to make up for my lost fishing years. When we're senior citizens, we have no idea how much time we have left. Is it 3 months or 30 years? In all likelihood, not 30 years. I have grandkids now, and I want to take them fishing. I want to teach them how to salmon fish, and I want them to have the same outdoor-oriented childhood I had. We need opportunities on the water. We need creative solutions that allow us to fish. Also, I look at what's been happening to our seasons the last 3 years, and I contrast it with a young fellow I've gotten to know up in Southeast Alaska. He has a YouTube channel and posted a video recently of he and a friend fishing in the 3-day Juneau Coho Derby last summer. The limit was 6 coho each per day. He and his friend caught and kept 36 coho over the space of 3 days. That doesn't count the Chinook and small coho they released. I have read that many of the salmon caught in Southeast Alaska and Canada are Washington and even Oregon fish. How is it right that a person can catch in 3 days what would be a good whole season total for many people in Washington, especially when many of those fish are from Washington rivers and hatcheries? I ask for a fairer distribution of fish between Southeast Alaska, Canada, and Washington. Thank you again for your time and attention.
Thank you for your comments, Mr. Henderson. Vice Chair Baker, I'm going to have to step away for a few moments. If you'll take the gavel, please.
I will, as long as Nikki's there to be my lifeline.
I'll do my best. All right, next, we've got Marie Newmiller, followed by Toby Cooper. Go ahead, Marie. Sorry about that.
No worries. Thank you, Commissioner. And thank you, Nikki, for your help. My name is Marie Newmiller, and I represent the Inland Northwest Wildlife Council. Since I began attending commission meetings, I have unfortunately noticed a concerning trend. It feels that any time a problem arises or concerns are brought to the commission, the knee-jerk reaction by some is to immediately blame hunters and fishers and to ban a season or style of take. Wildlife management in Washington State is a very complicated issue and requires a multifaceted approach. Recently, during the discussion of spring bear permit numbers, a concern about the orphaning of cubs was brought before the commission, and the swift emotional response by some was to ban spring bear hunting completely. This one-sided approach ignores the science out of Manitoba that showed that hunting accounted for less than 2% of the causes of cub orphaning. Other causes of cub orphaning include abandonment by a starving sow, sows killed by cars, sows killed in nuisance conflicts, and other causes. More recently, when the Wildlife Committee received a presentation on the cougar safety issue and the conflict rise in eastern Washington, we were presented with science that shows hunting leaves a leadership void and can increase conflict. What was ignored was several recent studies of the western state wolf reintroduction, showing that when cougars and reintroduced wolves share a landscape, that wolves will win. As stated in the study, overall puma dynamics in our multi-use landscape were more strongly influenced by top-down forces exhibited by a reintroduced apex predator than by human hunting or bottom-up forces like prey abundance subsidized by humans. The study found that in Wyoming, where wolf hunting was allowed, those wolves were likely to facilitate the maintenance of a higher density of puma in the study system. Radio collar studies showed a wolf pack systematically killing cougar kits and hunting in a way that pushed cougars to leave the area or starve. For me, this study highlights the need to look for balance in all wild populations and a need to balance all wild species. Also ignored at the recent meeting was the effectiveness of aversion training of predators by using livestock guard dogs and well-trained hounds in their handlers. Same for the effects of climate change on animal movement, urban sprawl, loss of habitat, and many other factors affecting the movements of cougars, not just the effects caused by hunters. Hunters, fishers, and conservationists have a passionate love for wildlife and wild spaces. I urge the commission to not treat hunters as a sole problem. This knee-jerk reaction to blame hunters and ban seasons removes a tool from the game management toolbox. You would be hard-pressed to build a house without a hammer. You will be hard-pressed to effectively manage wildlife without hunters in Washington State. Naturalism may have worked back in the days of Muir and Pinchot, when people were but a small blimp on the Western landscape. Unfortunately now, with urban sprawl and climate change, we must be more effective, proactive managers of our state's wild population. If a problem arises, I urge you to work with conservation groups like the Inland Northwest Wildlife Council to review all the science and find a solution that we can work on together. When we receive the call, groups like ours answer with all that we have. Wildfires in the Swanson Lake Wildlife Area received a generous outpouring of financial and volunteer hour donations. A need to study wildlife in the area brought the purchase of radio equipment and volunteers to help deploy those radio collars. Fencing that needs to be removed in the Wooten area, our volunteers worked hard to assist. Our volunteers are also currently gearing up to repair fences burned by fires. You presented to us that lead ammunition is creating a conservation issue, and we are starting the work to help find a solution. Working together, we can solve any problem facing Washington wildlife and wild spaces. Instantly blaming and banning only serves to drive a rift between the commission and hunters and fishers and conservationists, and it will hurt that cooperative effort we need to fix the problems in our state.
You're at time, Marie.
Okay, thank you. I just want to say I urge you to continue working with us to find solutions because we love wildlife and wild spaces and we want to help. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Neumiller. Nikki, next.
Next, we have Toby Cooper, followed by Raveo Leary. Go ahead, Toby.
Thank you, absent Mr. Chairman and Madam Standing Chairman. I would just like to comment on Commissioner Kuntz's earlier comment today concerning the cougar safety. I was not in attendance in the cheap seats in the back at the Friday cougar safety meeting. So for all I know, you talked about what I'm about to say, and I apologize if that's the case. But at least on today's record, it bears remarking that there is clearly a linkage, you know, between human safety and hunting policy. So I'm referring to, in particular, a paper by Tishman, Christou, and Derma. You probably know this paper. Sorry if I butchered their names. 2016 paper that discusses the social structure of cougars, which is in a stable population, characterized by a very rigid social order, social structure that's enforced by the dominant males. And if those males are removed, there is some disruption and younger males and younger lions start to explore and try out new things, and that's when conflicts arise. So a stable structure is really a safer structure for both humans and livestock. And the title of the paper is Cougar-Human Conflict is Positively Related to Trophy Hunting. So both human conflict and hunting are in the same title of the paper. And it just struck me when I heard Commissioner Kuntz say that gosh, that paper kind of summarizes what he's trying to say. And hopefully you've already seen this paper. There's other papers that reflect this as well. But clearly, the notion of considering hunting policy and safety in isolation is probably not the best way to go. And this scientific approach might lend some credibility there. So thanks very much.
Thank you for your comments, Toby. Nikki, who's next?
Lorna, do you have a comment for Toby or
a question?
You're muted.
Take my hand down, unmute myself. I actually had a comment for the previous speaker, for Marie Neumiller, because I could only hear about a third of what she was saying. So I was hoping maybe she had submitted some written comments. But just one comment I heard that caught my ear. She was talking about introduced predator, referring, I believe, to gray wolves, and just wanted to clarify that gray wolves in Washington, as we all know, were not introduced. They arrived here on their own 4 feet. So that's it.
Thanks,
Lorna. Okay, thank you. Thanks, Lorna. Nikki, next.
Next, we got Raveo O'Leary, followed by Irene and Kent. Go ahead, Raveo.
Thank you, Nikki, and thank you, commissioners, for providing the opportunity for a public comment today. Again, my name is Raveo Leary, and I'm a business owner in Forks, Washington. I wanted to make sure we keep the issue of coastal steelhead and the emergency regulations in front of you every chance we get. I hope you don't get too sick of me. At the last commission meeting, I requested the commission to take a firmer stance on emergency rules proposed by the department modifying the season regulations to allow fishing from a floating device on those river systems with projected returns above escapement. Although I know that has not completely fallen on deaf ears, I'm disheartened that it's not the direction the department or the commission will be considering for this season. It is clear that a true adaptive management process is not being followed in this decision, as there are no metrics available to know if this regulation change will achieve the poorly defined goal the department is hoping for. The one positive that has come out so far is that we've been promised there will be a public involvement program and an engagement plan going forward, and we'll be anxiously awaiting that. I hope in that plan, the flaws in utilizing town halls has been highlighted enough in this process, and those aren't the only component the department and commission are considering for public input. Additionally, I see that the Coastal Steelhead Workshop did make it on the agenda for the June meeting, and we're looking forward to that robust discussion and analysis of this decision. In the spirit of keeping the discussion going to better influence change, I want to reiterate some of the items that could use some further consideration from the commission. Given the timing of issues and not having the possibility of run estimates until what appears to be right before the season starts, and the fishing regulation book being effective July 1st, does the commission feel it's appropriate that the department consistently manage wild winter steelhead on the coast utilizing emergency rules? Instead, would it not be more appropriate that the department create regional management plans for each distinct population segment, as was directed in the statewide steelhead management plan, and what that was supposed to be completed by February of 2013. During the December 11th Special Fish Committee meeting that called this issue 3 days after the regulation changes were announced, and that had a record of more than 500 attendees, a promise was made that given the lack of time to hear from everyone, all questions received by email would be answered. Over 75 days later, no one in my social circle has received responses to our questions. Chair Carpenter had asked to be copied on those. I realize this isn't interactive, and I don't know if he's jumped back on yet, but I don't know if anyone else has received responses, but I know that we haven't. And I think that we can all agree that the turnout on that meeting was unprecedented and spoke to a major flaw in the process up to that point. It would be very good for public opinion if those responses were given to those questions that were posed. I would also like to ask the commission to reevaluate the utilization of no fishing from a floating device long-term. In the sport fishing change proposal for 2016-17, the commission put together a concise explanatory statement. And on page 60 of that, it defines the no fishing from a floating device rule that was put into place for a trial basis of the Upper Ho, and that that a study would be completed on that. I'd like to ask, thank you, I appreciate it.
Thank you, Rebe. Nikki.
Next we have Irene and Kent. Go ahead, Irene. Make sure to unmute yourself, Irene. There you go.
Okay, I think we've got it. Yes, I'm Irene Martin. I'd like to talk about the pound net experiment in Cathlamet Channel and the possibility of an emerging commercial fishery designation that's being proposed for this year. Part of the problem for proposing an emerging commercial fishery designation is that there have been very few numbers associated with the actual commercial portion of the fish trap on the Columbia. We have asked on a number of occasions for economic numbers. We have not been able to get them from the department or the Wild Fish Conservancy. So finally, we decided to put together our own numbers. And you should have received that document within the past month explaining what we were looking at. What we found under capital costs, we worked out numbers, which we can verify, of $156,000 to $258,000 for a pound net. In terms of capital costs. These vary according to site and so forth. And the Wild Fish Conservancy has pretty much said that this aligns with their numbers. We still have a number of other numbers that we need, like operational costs and so forth, which we've asked the Wild Fish Conservancy and WDFW for, and we hope we will get those. If not, we will try and work those out too. What I want to point out to the commission today is that this number, 156 to 258, $100,000 is the capital cost. The income produced so far from the fish trap annually, according to WDFW numbers, is an average of around $21,000 a year annual gross. Since we don't know the operational costs yet, we have no idea if there's any profitability. And those are numbers that really need to be worked on before we can even get to the point of thinking, is this even, does it have even potential for a commercial fishery? The other point I'd like to make is that no fishery occurs in a vacuum. There are viable fisheries all along the West Coast and elsewhere that fishermen could choose to invest with, in which have demonstrable, very good returns. In Alaska, for example, the investment cost is very similar to a pound net in both Bristol Bay and on Prince William Sound and Copper River. The annual income you get back from each of those is in the six figures, $206,000 from Bristol Bay, $112,000 from Prince William Sound, Copper River. We think that somewhere in that ballpark is what the pound net is going to need to produce in terms of a gross. But again, as I say, we don't have the numbers as yet, and we certainly don't have that kind of gross as yet from the pound net. The other things that are needed, aside from the operational costs, which we don't yet have, are things like real property purchase and lease fees, labor, marketing costs, and especially permitting costs. That is a huge black hole, which even I'm not brave enough to try and get into at this point. And one of the recommendations we've made is that the department hire a consultant. I don't think it's all that expensive. To please try and figure out what the permitting costs are going to be. This is a huge area for research. None of us is qualified to do it. We think, though, that we know of a consultant. I'm sure there's others out there that we would like to see the department please hire someone to help come up with these costs. Right now, the emerging fisheries, commercial fisheries designation is premature until we have some basic idea of costs, potential profits, capital costs we have, but all the rest of them are really out there, and we need to have some estimates. They can be a range. We're not expecting, you know, absolutely exact figures. We're looking at a range of numbers so that people can figure out, is this something I want to invest in, or are there better opportunities elsewhere? I can end my conversation now, and Kent is next.
Thank you.
Molly, do you have a comment for Irene?
I have a quick question. Irene, one thing that I have not heard anything about is, I'm wondering what the conversation around the commercial folks are for what maybe we at the department would call sort of cultural character. It seems like, you know, part of the commercial industry is, you know, the boats, the nets, the whole deal. Sorry, I'm really ignorant on this topic. And so I'm just wondering how the commercial folks feel about just such a big change from how commercial fishing might be done in the future.
That's an interesting question and will take a lot of time, but we can also talk offline if you would like to. The issues, there are several issues. Number one is certainly an employment issue. You're not going to be able to have as many pound nets on the river as you have gill netters because they're going to slurp up a lot of impacts, and there should be a high-volume fishery. That's going to dramatically change employment in these communities, and that's a big fear that's out there, that you know you might end up with, say, 10 pound nets as opposed to 150 gill netters on the river. That is a dramatic change in these communities, a dramatic change. It's a huge drop in employment, and depending on the business model of the pound net, you may not see significant revenues locally. If it's owned by an outside company, for example, most of those revenues will go elsewhere. That's one of the issues. Having said that, most commercial fishermen or commercial fishing businesses are what we think of as having permit portfolios. People don't operate usually with just one permit. They have a variety of permits and fish a variety of fisheries. For example, If I were just to use my husband and myself, our permit for portfolios consisted of a Columbia River Willapa gillnet permit, Bristol Bay gillnet permit, Southeast Alaska gillnet permit. And we utilized those fisheries on a seasonal basis. We took a look at what run sizes were going to be and evaluated where the risk was going to be in any given year and where we were going to fish. Other fishermen will have, say, a crab permit as well as a gillnet permit, or they may have a Alaska gillnet permit and a longline permit or a halibut permit, or halibut quota, actually. There are a lot of permutations on this, so it would not be impossible for a gillnet fisherman to decide, okay, I'm going to invest in a trap. That will fit my business model. The issue is, you're going to need to know what the costs are, the capital costs, the operational costs, the permitting costs, in order to make that decision, and the level of risk. Those are the questions people are going to be asking on this. And the other big part of it is, how does this fit our community economy? Does it fit? Does it change the whole character, for example, of the Washington Shore and the Lower Columbia River? Those are questions that have not been talked about at all. And from my perspective, at least, you bringing it up is something that I think is admirable, because not many other people have done so, but it's very important.
Thanks, Irene. Nikki, next?
Don has his hand up. Is it quick, Don?
Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
I bet you didn't expect quite that long a winded answer, but anyway. Well, you're a minister. You tend to be. Anyway, commissioners, my name is Kent Martin. I'm a commercial fisherman from Skamakaway, Washington. Speaking as someone who has fished the Columbia River since 1961 and is a lifelong professional fisherman, I would like to make a couple of comments on what I'm calling the alternative gear gold rush. This practice of expressing harvest in terms of release mortality percentages is very misleading, and it's confused a multitude of politicians and no less than four governors in the last couple of decades. Selective harvest is about actual numbers of dead non-target fish, not percentages. Percentages don't spawn, fish do. For example, 40% of 15 fish is obviously very different than 10% of 400 fish. Much of this confusion exists because avoidance, when and where you fish and the gear you fish, was not given much credence relative to the overall survival of released fish. The best kind of selectivity is controlling the encounters with the fish you do not want to catch. This is our major concern with alternative gear. None of it is selective. It catches everything. So release mortality rate may be very low, but the sheer volume of fish handled will likely mean an unacceptably high number of dead fish. The Wild Fish Conservancy has been saying they're working on a much more passive sorting mechanism in their fish trap that will lower encounter mortalities. When I asked Mr. Beardsley if this technology would perform at times of high volume catches, his response was, "That's a good question." And with a gear like this, high volume is critical to make it work. This is a very expensive and high-risk technology, and it is in no way ready for any kind of emerging fishery status. This especially in view of the fact that the WDFW will not commit to allowing the sale of anything but low-value clipped tules and clipped coho. Some of you may recall we've been down this road before with seines, and some of our fishermen dumped $100,000 of their own money into that mirage. We're capitalists, and if it looks like a potentially profitable venture, there will be fishermen coming forward. Right now, it looks like bait and switch. Thank you.
Thank you, Kent. Nikki, let's keep going here.
Question of clarification.
Oh, ahead, sorry Don. About that. Go ahead, Don.
Yeah, it's a question of clarification on the economic information. I was able to sit on the beginning of the Alternative Gear Advisory Body meeting earlier this week, and on the agenda was an update on the economics of PoundNet, economic costs of PoundNet. So my question is just, I guess this would be for Irene Martin and her testimony of all the economic costs. You said there are some outstanding things that haven't been tallied up yet. Did they get to that on the agenda? Because I had to leave the meeting and go to another call. Did they get to that on the agenda, or has that been postponed for a future meeting?
It was on the agenda. Kurt Beardsley said he didn't realize it was on the agenda, and so he was not prepared to offer anything. Aaron Jorgensen was also on the agenda and gave about 5 minutes, but it had nothing to do with economics. So what we did in response to that, finally, because we have asked for these numbers for a considerable period of time, we sent out a memo yesterday with a list of exactly what we want to know in terms of operational costs, things like insurance, L&I, this kind of thing. What are you paying for this stuff? That'll give us an idea of what operational costs are. And I think I sent you a copy of that, Don, because I knew you'd been on the meeting. And the other two commissioners that were on the meeting also, I sent a copy of that memo, plus some comments that were on it. My hope is we will get that. If not, we will turn around and dig out the numbers ourselves if we have to. But for this to go forward, we've got to have the numbers, and we didn't get them Thursday.
Okay, thank you. We just hope that was postponed to the next meeting.
Okay, so thanks, Don and Kent, or Irene. Nikki, next, please.
Next, we have Bruce Barnes, followed by Robert Kratzer. Go ahead, Bruce. Make sure to unmute yourself.
Can you hear me?
He can hear you.
Hey, my name is Bruce Barnes. Thank you, commissioners, for taking the time to listen to public testimony today. First of all, I'd like to find out, I've never been contacted about the DNR NAP program. Fish and Wildlife told me over a year ago and at the last commission meeting they were going to get back to me. Have not heard anything. Secondly, about e-bikes, we're going to petition for a rule change because the state law and the policy of the DNR and the Fish and Wildlife differ, and you guys have not reviewed motorized vehicles since 2009. We've been working through the Senate process with one of our state senators, actually a few of them. It passed through the Transportation Committee. They're putting a committee together. The problem is that they didn't invite e-bikers to this committee. Backcountry horsemen, mountain bikers, hikers, and everybody else was brought to this table except for the people that had the concern about being discriminated against. And not only that, but the disabled hunters in the state that use these e-bikes to access their hunting areas. To me, closure is not management in our state. And again, I want to reflect back to what was said earlier about the cougar surveys. We're not using local people and we're not doing surveys with our local biologists and stuff to figure out what is best for our state. We're always taking information from other states. We need to keep it in-house and we need to involve the public in this process. Thirdly, the Margaret Unit 524, there's rumors of closing the public lands on there because of confusion to hunters. Well, I got news for everybody on this commission and every hunter and biologist that would like to close this. Everybody has Onyx maps on their phone. There's no confusion of where the public land is versus Fish and Wildlife versus Weyerhaeuser versus whatever. I'm totally against closing of any public opportunity to use the land for access to waterways or access to hunting or access to recreation on our public lands. The other thing I want to touch on is I sent in some information from Klickitat County. This year I encountered 5 different mountain lions in the woods. Part of the problem is there's a serious lack of wildlife in the woods, so these animals are searching for other things to hunt, including human beings, in my opinion, because they're extremely aggressive. Two of those cougars were up at Marble Mountain. Three of those cougars were in Klickitat County. The game management units were 578, 382, and 560. So I think we need to take a really long look at what's going on with our predators. So far this year, my son and I have killed 76 coyotes. They're like rats in the woods. The farmers are all complaining about them. They're pulling calves out of the back of cows. You know what I mean? There's so many predators, it's unbelievable. I don't know how many bears I saw this year, but I'll tell you what I didn't see much of. Let me finish up. What I didn't see much of was a healthy herd of deer and a healthy herd of elk. So please take all these things into consideration. I appreciate your time and look forward to our petition on the rule change of motorized and non-motorized in the state of Washington. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Bruce. Nikki, next up.
Next, we have Robert Kratzer, followed by David Moskowitz.
Nikki, can I just ask you, how many more do we have?
Just four.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead, Robert.
Hey, my name is Robert Kratzer. I'm with Anglers Guide Service out here in Forks, Washington. I'm with the Olympic Peninsula Guide Association, also the Washington State Guides Association. I wanted to kind of piggyback with Vale O'Leary a little bit in that we wanted to keep this coastal steelhead issue kind of alive and being talked about. I'm also happy that it is on the agenda for June or July. I think it's important that it stays there. I think it's important that we continue to talk about it. And I think as we do that, I think they've talked about going to a public, more public meetings and maybe less ad hoc groups. And I would say that I would encourage the commission to talk to the department about it, continuing to work with their ad hoc groups, continue to work with local guide associations, continue to work with their guide advisory committee that they've put together. Those folks spend their entire every single day on these waters. They have innate knowledge of these runs and they can help formulate plans moving forward on these. So I encourage you guys to keep that coastal steelhead issue alive, continue to talk to the department about it. And then the other issue I would bring up is have the department and you folks also look at the recent study that just came out of Idaho Department of Fish and Wildlife, who did a very intensive study on catch and releasing salmon and steelhead and their productivity after being released. And also the mortality rates and so forth. I would look into that study. We don't have any studies here in Washington that look at those things. And so some of the decisions that are being made on decisions that the Idaho study has looked at. So I would encourage that we look at those, we keep this steelhead coastal issue alive and so forth. So thank you very much, Commission, for letting us testify today. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you for taking the time, Robert. Nikki, next.
Next, we have David Moskowitz, followed by Jeffrey Effenberger. Go ahead, David.
Hi, thank you very much. Can everyone hear me okay?
We can hear you.
Thank you so much. My name is David Moskowitz with the Conservation Angler. And I'd like to make some comments about the public involvement discussion that occurred sometime at the January meeting and then was discussed today with some potential changes to that process. First, I'd like to agree with Robert Sudar's comments on public testimony. I thought those were very, very well made. Certainly, your agendas are very robust, and the virtual meeting format has really increased the access for the public to engage with the department and the commission. And I guess the question will be, once those COVID precautions are no longer necessary, what will the commission do in the future? Because you've opened this avenue for people to engage with you that can't necessarily make it to Olympia or wherever you meet. So that's a future question that I think should be considered. the goal of the Administrative Procedures Act and this public involvement is to really allow the public to give their say. I would say Washington has done a tremendous job allowing public testimony in this new world of virtual meetings. I really commend you, the department staff and the commission for doing this. I'm a little concerned with some of the rules that Deputy Director Winthrop described based on your discussions with the Big Tent and perhaps an executive session. I'm concerned about limitations actually on the back and forth that takes place. I think that, and I wish Chair Carpenter was in his seat. I think he does an excellent job of directing staff to respond to very valid and heartfelt comments that the public makes, on the spot. Please, will you reach out to Mr. or Mrs. So-and-so to address their concern? That shows responsiveness. And it's really part of what this commission meeting process is supposed to be. And so I've been very impressed. Oregon does not allow as much access. And it's a real problem. And I've been working on that with that commission and department. There are clearly some things that can be done to make sure that the commission can get its business done with these robust agendas. And there's deadlines, reasonable deadlines on public comment and written testimony. They're necessary for you to be able to move ahead. Chair Carpenter, David Moskowitz here, and I'm just I'm talking briefly about some concerns with the public testimony discussion that took place. And I would ask that that some of these things be considered. And actually, what should happen is that the recommendations that were outlined to today's meeting should be distributed to the public for their comment before they're adopted. And it sounded like what I heard today, and I might be mistaken, was that these were going to be put into place by the next commission meeting. Okay, I just want to say that's a reasonable thing to do, but the public should have a chance to comment on those. And I want to just say one more time that we really commend the patience and the diligence with which the Washington Commission does handle public comments. It's very impressive, and I'd like to also commend your staff. And I can't believe it's just one person that does this, but Nikki does an incredible job. I thank her for her professionalism and diligence, and thank you for this opportunity. I hope you'll give all the public a chance to comment. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments, Mr. Moskowitz. Vice Chair Baker, thank you very much. It took a little longer than I thought. Nikki, next, please.
Next, we have Jeffrey Effenberger, followed by Greg King, and those are our last two. Go ahead, Jeff. Sorry, Jerry. Make sure to unmute yourself. Give him a moment.
I got it. Can you hear me now?
Yep, we can hear you.
Okay, my name is Jerry Effenberger, and I am a concerned citizen. My comments today are regarding the WDFW emergency steelhead rule that prohibits fishing from a floating device. The stated objective of this rule appears to merely be to reduce encounters by 50%. I'm not aware of any other objective or goal that has been provided, and certainly not aware of any methodology that has been established to determine the effect or outcome of this rule. It's kind of my opinion that this is somewhat intentional and that WDFW already knows what the outcome will be. This rule will provide absolutely no benefit to the resource while creating significant additional economic import impact to our coastal communities already suffering from extremely a year of lockdown. It's really inconceivable that WDFW is unaware of the numerous scientific studies that have already concluded that catch and release produces minimal impact on the future of a caught and release fish. Further, these scientific studies, for the most part, were concluded during a period of time when bait, scent, and multiple point hooks were legal. For the past several years, the use of bait or scent has been prohibited, and only one single point barbless hook allowed. That's prevented deep hooking of any steelhead and has virtually completely eliminated producing a resort survival rate to the spawning grounds of virtually 100%. It's also inconceivable that WDFW is unaware of the actions which must be taken if this extremely valuable resource is to have a chance to not only survive, but hopefully abundantly thrive. And once again, maybe approach measures of where it was about 45 years ago. Those actions, in my opinion, have to include the elimination of commercial harvest. The mortality rate of wild steelhead in tribal nets is 100%. Net restrictions within 2 miles of the mouth of any major coastal river should be implemented. We need significant reductions in the numbers of sea lions and seals. They're harvesting a ton of fish. In addition, significant reduction in numbers of mergansers and cormorants. There have been scientific studies that have indicated that these birds are responsible for elimination of approximately 80% of the steelhead and salmon smolt before they ever reach salt water. In addition to the huge negative financial impact of this rule to coastal communities, and I know I alone spent over the last 3 years an average of $4,100 a year in coastal communities attempting to harvest a steelhead or two. And of course, the certainty that there will not be any positive resource benefit. This rule that really should be eliminated immediately. The rule is also discriminatory. The elderly and disabled are virtually precluded from fishing while the young and healthy are still floating the rivers and able to get in and out of the drift boats and rafts they're the only ones allowed to harvest fish. At a bare minimum, WDFW should immediately amend this draconian rule exempting the elderly and the disabled from the onerous provisions. So
thank you for
the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Mr. Effenberger, for your comments today. Next, Nikki, please.
The last one is Greg King. Go ahead, Greg.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Good morning, Chair Carpenter, Deputy Director Windrup, and Commission. Mm-hmm. It's been a week. It's been a week from all the way from Columbia River Compact on Tuesday, where we listened to the Shoshone-Bannock tribe and the Yakima Nez Perce tribe scream for fish in the upper Columbia. Shoshone-Bannock tribe only gets 3 ceremonial fish for 6,000 tribal members. My God, went to smelt, went to compact, smelt compact. That even the commercials want the sports to have a dip season, and we're waiting for health department so we can get it smelt dip for sports. But the most trying one was the alternative gear committee that spoke. I think it was Thursday. Thank you, Commissioner McIsaac, and any other commissioners were there. We found out that there's a second trap going to be developed at Clifton Channel. And what was so troubling is there was no open public comment. We never heard anything. Now pilings are drove, and we had no public comment. And it's just amazing how that slipped by all of us. But a little bit on pound nets. They were outlawed in 1938, and only the rich had pound nets. Only the rich canneries had pound nets on the lower Columbia River. And this is going to take, I think, and Wild Fish Conservancy was very vague on their presentation and their numbers on everything pound nets that they're doing. And our concern in the sports fishing community is these pound nets are only going to pass wild fish above. Now, what does that do for sports fishermen fishing above that? It does nothing. It actually creates a release mortality problem, I think. And how many fish do they handle, especially steelhead, do they handle in those pound nets the more fish we handle in a pound net, the higher the mortality rate goes up. And these are stationary pound nets. You can't move them. So, you better have the right spot or you're not going to be able to catch fish, and it's not going to be profitable for you as a commercial fisherman. And but it goes back to the you're passing only wild fish above. And on the Callis River and other rivers, we're using hatchery fish as a recovery tool. And if you're not letting those hatchery fish pass up the river, then how do you recover wild fish? So it's very, you know, it's a very interesting topic. We'd like to know more about this, you know, but the most trying thing, like I said, is not having any open public comment on this. And it was kind of seemed like it was, how can I say it?
You got time, Greg.
Suspicious, to say the least, of all of a sudden we got a pound net on the Oregon side and we didn't do anything about it. So anyway, there's my comments today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Greg. Commissioner Thorburn has her hand up, please. Commissioner Thorburn.
Thank you. Thanks for all the testimony. I attended the half of the Alternative Gear Advisory Committee meeting, and I appreciate all the comments from testifiers today about it, and the questions and response from Irene and Ken. When we revised the Columbia River policy, we encouraged the continuation of looking for alternative and selective gear to the gillnets. We encouraged it to be a community-based activity where the user groups are sort of involved. And I was really concerned that this was called an advisory committee meeting, and there, you know, the advisors commented, but it was, you know, it was just kind of presented to them. I feel like this process is proceeding kind of contrary to the policy that we adopted. And I mean, we're hearing real concerns about the pound net as an alternative and selective gear. It's more like a vacuum cleaner that's going to suck up all the fish that pass through it.
Thank you, Commissioner Thorburn. Commissioner McIsaac, and then Deputy Windrup.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think that concludes public comment. So I've got a couple of things in reaction to what we've heard about from public comment.
Hey, Don, make sure you speak up because you're really faint.
Okay. Let me try to change that if I can there. So, yes, at the end of public comment, a couple of reactions to some things we heard. First, on the matter of the coastal steelhead, we heard some testimony from Ms. O'Leary and Mr. Kratzner about a workshop on the agenda. It does show up in our year at a glance, but the June event that's on our year at a glance is a briefing to the commission about the workshop being planned. It's not the actual workshop. We can talk a little bit more about that under future meeting planning. On the matter of the e-bikes petition, maybe again later at future meeting planning, I'm interested in hearing a little bit more about what the commission does when a petition is received. We didn't get a chance at the last meeting. We ran out of time before having much of a discussion at the end about the e-bike testimony that was so voluminous at the January meeting. But I would like to hear a little bit more about that whole thing and have a discussion of it. And then lastly, the matter of the alternative gear testimony that we heard here, maybe at the director's report, maybe not at this meeting, maybe at the director's report in March, it would be good to hear about this advisory body. Commissioner Thorburn said that the new policy, the revised policy, is more of a bottoms-up approach. The previous trying to emphasize alternative gear didn't work out too well, and a lot of that had to do with it being a top-down approach. And so the new policy talks about both commercial and recreational folks being involved in the development, and the key to the success of all that is that people do support it from the bottom up. And I'm hearing now about a Clifton Channel new pound net site that's got piling, permanent pilings driven in it. That is a popular sport fishing location in the spring. Those flats on the Clifton Channel, if there's pilings in there now, it would have been nice that, that might have passed through our advisory body. And I don't know when I look at the membership that there were any recreational folks on that advisory body. So there's a lot of questions here about the economics, about what that advisory body is doing. I'm glad to see we have an advisory body on this. But I think maybe, again, we can talk about it under future meeting planning, that maybe as a director's report in March, we hear a little bit more about this alternative gear, emerging gear development process and how it fits into the revised policy in terms of a new emphasis on trying to try to get there.
Thank you, Commissioner McIsaac. Commissioner Smith, we got to go to Deputy Director Windrow.
I'll be quick. I mostly just want to say I agree with Don that we really, I for one, need to know a lot more about the options on alternative gear. I think some of the possibilities could be very exciting from a conservation standpoint. I don't know about the economics, but I sure would welcome the opportunity to learn more about those projects. That's it.
Thank you, Commissioner Smith. Okay, Greg King, if you're listening, we're not going to be able to go back and take more public testimony at this point. Deputy Director Windrow, please.
Thank you, Chair Carpenter. I wanted to just clarify some of the steps that we've done relative to communicating answers to questions to the steelhead community. We did gather the questions from all the emails that we received, and we collectively put them into an FAQ that's posted online. So we are not sending out emails to individual people. We gathered all of their different questions, sorted through them, and have it in one place online under an FAQ. We also reviewed questions. We received questions from Senator Vandeweghe about essentially channeling questions from his constituents in the Steelhead Guide community. And we responded directly to Senator Vandeweghe with in-depth answers to his questions, which we're assuming he provided as well. Director Suzwin and Chair Carpenter met with the Steelhead community earlier this week, I believe, and technical questions were raised, and a meeting has been set up with the Steelhead Guide community, I believe for next Tuesday, with Director Kelly Cunningham to go over some of those technical answers. So we are continuing to, be as responsive as we can, as broadly as we can, to an issue that continues to be really challenging. Thank you, Chair Carpenter.
Thank you. I might add the meeting that Kelly and I had with the coastal folks. We agreed to put together a virtual meeting in April. And I told the stakeholders that I would include three or four commissioners, and we intend to meet with them, and we owe them a follow-up letter, Amy. They asked for a letter from Kelly and I about what our plans, timing, and strategies are, and I think that's very appropriate, just so everyone knows that. Anything else? I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's Nikki. The only thing Greg wanted to comment on is he said there was no sports fishermen on the alternative advisory group on Thursday.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Okay. Well, that concludes agenda item two, open public input. And I'm sorry I missed more of that than I would have liked. But we now go to number three, and we are within a minute, 2 minutes of our schedule. Director's report, Deputy Director Windrow, please.
Okay. I'll do the best I can here. So there was a lot of conversations this week around the point, no point ramp issue. There was a meeting with Colonel Bullock in early February. There was a subsequent government-to-government meeting as well. So that issue is continuing to be worked. We have hosted a couple of different internal meetings and all-staff meeting regarding updates to the COVID vaccine and how it's being distributed and how our staff fit into the prioritization of that. We also had our two-day spring diversity advisory committee meeting in February. We continue to work with the co-manager improvement work group. That's really a small group of co-managers to figure out how to continue to move the dialogue in a productive way.